Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents First Wilderness, My Quest in the Territory of Alaska, Revised Edition, by Sam Keith, narrated by Michael Kirby. The Land of Beyond. Have ever you heard of the Land of Beyond, that dreams at the gates of the day? Alluring it lies at the skirts of the skies, and ever so far away. Alluring it calls, O ye the yoke galls, and yet of the trail overfond, with saddle and pack, by paddle and track, let's go to the land of beyond. Have ever you stood where the silences brood, and vast the horizons begin? At the dawn of the day, to behold far away the goal you would strive for a win? Yet, in the night, when you gain to the height, with the vast pool of heaven star-spawned, afar and agleam, like a valley of dream, still mocks you a land of beyond. From Rhymes of a Rolling Stone by Robert W. Service. Forward. An Unmet Friend by Nick Jans. I never met Sam Keith, but wish I had. His Alaska sojourn ended in 1955, the year I was born, and he arguably had more in common with my father, a fellow child of the Great Depression and a Marine combat veteran of World War II, than I. Yet, Sam and I traveled parallel trails, decades apart. We were both young English majors, fresh out of back east colleges, yearning for something more, a wider horizon on which to stretch our dreams. That hope, and our shared, abiding love of the natural world, led us across the continent and northward thousands of miles to Alaska. Neither of us had a fallback plan. Half broke and boxed in, we just went, led by the eternal optimism and inexhaustible energy of youth. And the great land proved everything we hoped for and more. Its sprawling, careless beauty became woven into our being, inseparably twined with the stories of our lives. Alaska, being the almost unimaginably vast state that it is, Sam and I ended up many hundreds of miles apart. But as I read First Wilderness, I can imagine myself alongside Sam on Kodiak Island, pulling long, hard hours working in the company of rough men, catching his first salmon, tagging along with his soon-to-be lifelong friend Dick Prenicky on a bear hunt, camping at the mouth of a remote stream as a neophyte fish warden, navigating a stretch of the wild Kenai Peninsula rapids in an outboard skiff. The words ring true and vivid. Keith's writing bursts with exuberance. At its best, it exhibits a crafted visual style verging on brilliance. During the next few days, Bruce showed me a flock of sandhill cranes settling in a moose meadow. Some of them almost somersaulted as they landed. They had an ethereal presence as they rose, wheeling above us like vapors, clouding, spreading, thinning, and coming together again. They made a whooping, purring racket that descended upon us. More often, the writing tends toward sturdy, workmanlike cadences, suited perfectly to the story at hand. Always, the prose is engaging and fast-paced, almost breathless. We sense the raw excitement of a young Sam scribbling late at night in his journal or penning letters home, searching for the words to describe a land so wide and deep, and to capture the essence of the people he meets along the way. Though the narrative revolves around a series of on-the-move adventures set against the backdrop of Alaska's territorial days, The more profound journey is inward. Above all, First Wilderness is, as the subtitle states, the story of a quest. A young man searching for a direction and purpose in life. Alaska, no matter how alluring, ultimately proves waypoint rather than destination for Sam Keith. We can feel the pull his beloved Father Merle and Sister Anna exert, drawing him back to that other world. Throughout the tale, too, the beauty of Alaska competes with Keith's yearning for feminine companionship. Equally as beguiling as snow-capped peaks are a head-turning beauty on a Seattle bus and a redhead on the Coast Guard base where Keith serves as a civilian construction worker. These connecting threads lend thematic undercurrents that pulse through the book. Given the distinctly autobiographical perspective, what Sam Keith chose to omit from First Wilderness offers telling insight. There's not a word about Sam's experiences as a bomber crewman just a few years earlier. No mention of his being shot down over the trackless ocean and surviving. He seemed to have consciously resisted mining the dichotomy between the destructive power of war and the restorative properties of nature a la Hemingway, though it offered an obvious and natural theme to explore. Why indeed would a born storyteller avoid so much as a reference to what must have been the most harrowing and dramatic experiences of his life? According to his daughter Laurel, "I think he simply saw the war as something he had endured and survived. It was in his past, and he always wanted to focus on the future." And truly, that forward-focused optimism brims throughout First Wilderness. Alaska provides a new beginning for Sam Keith in every sense of the word. He went on from there to find the purpose he yearned for as an educator through someone he met in Alaska. And later on, he met Jane, the love of his life at a home movie showing of his adventures. Through understated foreshadowing, Keith sustains narrative tension, preparing us for his eventual farewell to Alaska. Close attention to the text hints he clearly sensed his trail diverging from that of Dick Prenicke, whose classic story of solitary wilderness living and self-sufficiency Sam would later carve in One Man's Wilderness. He seemed to realize that his own destiny lay in the company of others rather than alone. Throughout the rest of his life, though, Prenicke's experiences served as a reminder of the trail not followed. Sam and Dick's long-distance friendship, constantly renewed through hundreds of letters, would keep Alaska welded to his soul. Dick Prenicke was truly both avatar and doppelganger for Sam. No surprise that the two friends passed from this world just weeks apart. Sam Keith lives on through his family and those whose lives he touched, and no less so in his enduring contribution to Alaskan literature. First Wilderness, this posthumous offering, cements that legacy. Introduction. Buried Treasure by Brian Lees. This is a book that almost didn't happen. Sam Keith, the author of the award-winning book One Man's Wilderness, passed away in 2003. 4 years later, his widow, Jane, moved from their retirement home in Anderson, South Carolina, back to Massachusetts, where Sam and Jane had lived for many years. Jane's new apartment didn't have much storage space, so during the move, a dozen archive boxes of Sam's, filled with letters, journals, unpublished manuscripts, photographs, and slides, went instead to a garage. Our garage. You see, I'm married to his beloved daughter, Laurel. Laurel and her father were kindred spirits. For years after his death, the boxes sat untouched on steel shelves at the back of our garage. Opening them was just too painful. The boxes collected dust until the winter of 2013, when thoughts about their contents started to nag me. I knew there were stories in there that Sam had written, but never published. A junior high school English teacher for 26 years, he routinely came home after school, napped in his favorite chair, then wrote. He kept a journal almost every day of his life. Sam had written One Man's Wilderness in 1972, recounting the story of his longtime friend Dick Prenicky, who'd chosen to build a log cabin in remote Alaska and live a subsistence lifestyle. Using interviews, notes, and Dick's journals, Sam had written a bestseller. Now, 40 years after the book's initial release, and long after it was reissued in paperback, sales were still strong. Standing in our garage, I looked at the shelves and wondered, what if there's another publishable manuscript in there? Pushing past our snow thrower and Christmas decorations, I began to pull the boxes from the shelves. Inside one, I found a smaller cardboard box. On its lid were the words, "Raw Quest," written in Sam's distinctive handwriting. I lifted the lid to find a thick stack of onion skin paper, a typed manuscript. A quick look told me that this was Sam's autobiographical account of his first trip to Alaska, during which he met and shared many adventures with Dick Prenicky, as well as other remarkable men whom he befriended. Wow, I thought. This could be it. I started reading the pages, hoping that there was a real story there rather than just journal entries. Soon I realized I was no longer reading because the author was my father-in-law, whom I'd respected and loved. I was reading because this man's adventures in the territory of Alaska were at turns harrowing, funny, and fascinating. A letter home from a different time, and from the one remaining wilderness in North America. I couldn't wait to tell Laurel what I'd found. When she read it, she discovered a facet of her father that she'd never known. Laurel agreed. This story needed to see daylight. Sam's life before the events of this book was already marked by adventures. He was born in Plainsfield, New Hampshire in 1921, and raised by loving parents with his younger sister, Anna, whom he adored. Sam's father, Merle Vincent Keith, was a talented wildlife artist who never found the success he yearned for, and who worked a variety of manual jobs to try to support his family. The family moved frequently, from New Hampshire to Massachusetts, and then to Bayside on Long Island, New York, where Merle felt his proximity to the New York publishing world would offer more opportunities for success. But the Great Depression hit them hard, and the publishing work never materialized. The family's financial difficulties left lasting marks on Sam. Personal scars from being forced to accept government aid as a boy, and feelings of obligation to family, which stayed with him throughout his life. To the end of his days, he was extremely humble, downplaying his own skills and talents, and poking fun at his own mistakes. Merle Keith taught Sam and Anna about hunting, nature, and outdoor skills. Nature was a release from the hardships of life, a place both real and imagined, in which a person could survive and even flourish given the right skills and mindset. Nature was a sacred thing, to be honored and conserved. It would play an important role in his writing. He hoped one day to write a story that his father would illustrate and the two would find success together. On graduation from high school in 1940, Sam joined the Civilian Conservation Corps and spent a year building fire suppression roads in Elgin, Oregon. Then he returned to Long Island to work as a landscaper before enlisting in the Marines in May 1942. He would serve as a radio gunner in the Billy Mitchell Marine Bombing Squadron of the Flying Nightmares and survive being shot down over the Pacific Ocean. Later, he was awarded several decorations for his military service. After the war, Sam attended Cornell University on the GI Bill, earning a degree in English literature in 1950. He filled countless journals with observations about nature, people, and life, the stuff that might later become stories. But after graduation, a sense of duty drew him back to help out at home. His mother had passed away while he was in college, and his father remarried. The household now included Merle, his new wife, Molly, and mother-in-law, Mrs. Millett. Instead of striking out and pursuing his dream, Sam took a job in a machine shop. He began to chafe. He wanted more. He needed an adventure, a purifying experience in which he could find out what he was really made of. The territory of Alaska had always called to him, and at last, he made up his mind to go. The following adventure stories from Alaska begin in 1952, and in them, you'll meet that man in search of adventure and acceptance. You'll hear about how he met Dick Prenicky and how their lifelong friendship began. And you'll meet a number of colorful characters who inhabited the place that would, in 1959, become the 49th state. Sam wrote this manuscript in his after-school hours of 1974. Neither his wife nor his daughter was aware that he'd written another book. In preparing it for publication, Laurel and I, working with our insightful editor, Tricia Brown, have changed as little as possible. Occasionally, we found that his letters or journal entries about a particular event were fresher or more vivid than the manuscript version and would be more interesting to a modern audience, so we've tucked them in. We've included excerpts of his letters home, shedding additional light on his thoughts or actions. And we've also pared away some small bits, overly long descriptions or observations that got in the way of telling the story. The following is Dad's distinctive voice, already familiar to many thousands who have read One Man's Wilderness. So, please meet Sam Keith, at last telling his own story in First Wilderness. Preface. Longings. At a party in Massachusetts one winter evening in the early 1970s, several of us men drifted away from our wives and gathered in front of a snapping blaze in the fireplace. We sipped our drinks and stared into flames that turned our conversation from current events to our primitive longings. We strayed easily from talk of the Trans-Alaska pipeline. "I was all set to go in 48," one said, "right down to the military jeep and two spares. But we never got the show on the road. My roommate up and decided he wanted to go on for a master's, and I met Nancy." Another man leaned in. "I was another casualty. I had it all figured out. I was going to be a wilderness trapper way back of beyond somewhere. The Porcupine, the Pelly, the Athabasca. I dreamed about marten and lynx and wolverines and sourdough biscuits. Read all the books. Still have 'em somewhere. I settled for my father's meat business. Ain't it ever since." "You won't believe this. Right after I got out of the service, all I could think about was Ketchikan. Commercial fishing. That was the life for me. I had a name all picked out for that 40-footer I was going to own. The Northern Lady. Somehow, it just don't sound the same plastered on a canoe." I heard the same sad tunes before. On and on stretched the tombstones with their eroded epitaphs of what was going to be, yet never came to pass. We all have our Alaska, in one form or another. It's a place we never got to see, a goal we never reached, a dream that stayed that way. I was one of the lucky ones. I mind some of those dreams we talked about as boys, before responsibility descended with its straitjacket. I saw things I dreamed of seeing. I did things that I dreamed of doing. I prospected my Alaska and discovered new placers in myself. That big, awesome land brought out the pieces like flashes of gold in black sand. Chapter 1. Out of the Nest. My father, Merle V. Keith, tilted his head to appraise the sketch he was making of a Drakewood duck, sighed softly, and peered up at me over the top of his glasses.
Are you really going?
My mind's made up, I said. There'll never be a better chance than right now. No excuses. And the longer I wait, the more I'll have a chance to make them. I'm single and have $500 stashed away. I'm busting to head out. Find something to write about.
You sound like a teenager, not a 30-year-old.
Maybe it's delayed action. Marine Corps, then college, and that damn machine shop. I'm wound up like a spring. Anna's all set now, and you're off on another tack. I'm all turned around. I'm not sure what I want to do, and even if I did, I don't feel ready to do it. Alaska's been talking to me day and night. And that's partly your fault. You planted that seed a long time ago. Dad smiled. His bald dome gleamed beneath the fluorescent lamp, and his gray fringe of hair made me think of a victor's wreath. He stared right through the sketch he was drawing.
There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold, he recited. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold.
You introduce me to them all, I said. Not just Robert Service, Jack London and Rex Beach, and James Oliver Curwood, and Stuart Edward White. Dad bent forward on his stool and made the Drake on the paper come alive with a highlight in its eye.
I'm not sorry about that, he said. You can take away a lot of things, but you can't take away a man's dreams.
He looked up at me with those gentle blue eyes.
I can understand the way you feel. You're like a bird dog casting the cover for a scent. One thing you want to remember, though. You don't always find the birds in the cover that's the prettiest or the farthest away.
Dad dabbed his brush at the palette to pick up more paint.
I read a poem that I've never forgotten. I've looked for it for years, but I'm ashamed to say I don't even know the name of it. It starts off like this. There is a legend that often has been told of the boy who searched for windows of gold, the beautiful windows he saw far away. When he looked in the valley at sunrise each day.
Dad had been looking at the ceiling as he recited, but now he turned back to me.
He had to see those golden windows. One day he climbed up there to see them, but they weren't gold at all. They were just plain windows. When he looked back across the valley to his own house, though, the windows there had turned to gold.
Dad paused for effect.
But that's enough philosophy. Go to it. I might see that big country after all. I hope you find what you're looking for.
He knew my dream was to make a living with my stories, to be a professional writer. Despite my best efforts, that just hadn't happened yet. Dad's eyes dropped for a moment as he made deft strokes to bring out the Drake's crest.
To find it, you've got to have some idea what it looks like.
I was going to miss my visits with my father in his studio, there in West Bridgewater, Massachusetts. It was a delightful mess, with its paintings, sketches, photographs, carvings, plaster casts, animal skulls, specimens in formaldehyde, driftwood branches, paper wasp nests, birds' nests, cocoons, swamp grass, reeds, milkweed pods, garlands of bittersweet, bird skins, tubes of paint, and pallets blotched like autumn leaves. The place smelled of linseed oil and the fresh pine shavings that littered the floor. Sayings were tacked on the wall. "A quitter can't win," was a saying that rallied his persistence whenever it flagged. Another was the golden rule. Yet another read, "Don't wait for your ship to come in. Row out to meet it." Here was Dad's escape from the world. His illustrations of my unsold stories were not only reminders of my failures, but endorsements of his striving spirit. I wondered if every young man was as mixed up as I was. I had taken advantage of the GI Bill and attended Cornell University in the fall of 1946. Torn between majoring in English and wildlife conservation, I had chosen the former and filled in with the latter wherever I could. It had only been 3 years since my mother's death. Her passing marked the end of home as I knew it. Dad had remarried quickly, and my sister Anna and her family had moved into the old house. After graduation from Cornell in 1950, I had boarded with Anna and pounded out articles and short stories that earned a steady income of rejection slips. A small inheritance from my grandmother and income from odd jobs had furnished the necessities while I sat behind the typewriter and watched the mailbox. My account petered out about the same time Anna obtained a divorce. With 3 kids and a big house, she needed help. I had taken a job in a machine shop. It paid more than some of the other jobs available, and a neighbor who worked in the plant provided the transportation. "A college graduate and you're working here?" That was a question I could neither answer to my satisfaction nor to the one who asked it. It was a matter of expediency. I was dazed, confused, and even bitter. I was a young Indian brave waiting for a vision. I wrote often in my journal, a habit I would keep up for life, and one that helped me sort through colliding thoughts. Author's Journal, June 15, 1950. "I can't allow myself to fall into a rut now that I am fresh out of college. I must be on my guard, for pitfalls are numerous. I hear the call of northern places, and soon I must heed their pleadings." The Great Depression had left ugly psychological scars on my family. How often I thought of Dad being forced to make a living as a laborer, something he despised, because he had a family to support. He was first an artist, but he had only been able to play at his calling. That wasn't going to happen to me. But what was going to happen? How I envied the boys in high school and later those in college who knew exactly where they were going. Everything they did was tailored to a pattern. Everything I did was trial and error. I also had a hang-up about women. I looked upon a woman as doing me a favor to tolerate my attention, and never from the viewpoint that she might be flattered by it. I stuttered. I stammered. I didn't consider myself much of a bargain. Neighbors and acquaintances did their best to make a match for me. I was not only cheating myself, they said, I was cheating some nice girl out of the good life. From my war perspective, marriage was a trap. I regarded it as an ending rather than a beginning, a stifling of the adventurous spirit, a sentence I wasn't ready to accept.
Dad had made a very necessary adjustment after my mother's death. He was starting anew.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?